On an upcoming Motley Fool radio show, we're talking about your smartest investments and your dumbest investments. Perhaps you bought shares of Google when it IPO'd and you've seen that investment nearly triple since September. Perhaps you bought a house right before the real estate market exploded. Maybe you decided to invest in a timeshare that didn't quite work out. Or maybe you spent a bundle on some product you saw in a TV infomercial that didn't quite perform as promised. These don't just have to be strictly financial, by the way. Your smartest investment could have been going to college, your dumbest and exotic car that refused to run. Either way, we're pretty sure you'll feel better after getting it off your chest. Again, your smartest and dumbest investments on an upcoming Motley Fool radio show. Call in now and tell us about yours. The number is 866-NPR-FOOL. That's 866-677-3665. We are now joined by a veteran Fool Radio guest, New York Times contributor, and author, Michael Lewis. His many books include Liar's Poker, The New Thing, and Moneyball. His latest book is Coach, Lessons on the Game of Life. He joins us from New York City. Michael Lewis, welcome back to the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Michael, we want to talk about your new book, Coach, in a minute, but we want to begin by talking Google for a sec. It's a red-hot stock. Michael, you're a student of Silicon Valley, you're a student of Wall Street. What do you make of Google?
Well, you know, it's very fun, David. Every time I come on your show, you try to turn me into a stock market guru. And the first lesson that anybody should have drawn from Liar's Poker is I'm the last person you should ask about your money. And now, I think Google is obviously a really interesting company. I have no idea what it should be worth. The one thing I would say, since you've asked, I'm allowed to say, you know, even though I don't know what I'm talking about, I preface it with that. I do think that there is a very weird tendency for technology stocks to get dramatically overvalued. It's as if the market forgets that the same rapid innovation that created the company could also destroy it, that someone could come along with a better Google or with a competitive Google or with a, and that there's no reason why Google has to be the dominant force in the search market 10 years from now. Mm-hmm. And so it always surprises me that sort of understanding of how quickly the creative destructive process works in the technology business doesn't seem to inform the valuation of the stocks.
Your new book is Coach. It's a book about the lessons you learned from your high school baseball coach. Michael, begin by just telling us a bit about Coach Fitz.
Sure. Billy Fitzgerald at the Isidore Newman School in New Orleans, Louisiana, arrived when I was in the seventh grade, and he was a two-sport star at Tulane University. He'd been drafted in the first round by the Oakland A's. He's 6'4", 220-pound catcher, and he's a very tough guy, and unlike anything this private school had ever seen. And I remember when we first kind of encountered him. We had the seventh grade basketball team played on the court next to the eighth grade basketball team. And Coach Fitz turned up in this first place to coach the eighth grade basketball team. And we had a great team. We were 64-1 over our 2 years in middle school. We had a great player who went on to be drafted by the New Jersey Nets, a kid named Sean Toohey. And we would just go play, though. Our coach would sort of throw the balls out on the court. We'd have fun. All of a sudden, on the eighth grade court, they're running wind sprints when they do things wrong and they don't run the plays. And he's barking these orders. And it's like a Marine boot camp. And he finishes his practices with the kids collapsed on the end of the on the end line. And he pulls out from his back pocket the collected writings of Bobby Knight and begins to sort of read them aloud so that we can hear them. And I can remember Sean Toohey turning to me and saying, "Please, God, don't let me get to the eighth grade because I don't want any part of this man." But we all ended up having a part of this man. And he was this person in my life, and I realized I wanted to write about him when I turned 40 and I was still hearing his voice in my head. And I just thought, this wasn't just about coaches, it was also about teachers who infiltrate your mind when you're 14, 15, 16 years old, and they never quite leave. And I wanted to write about why that was and how this particular man had done that. The short story is that I went back to go see him. He's still coaching. He's in his late 50s. He's mellowed a bit, not much, and found that hundreds of his former players had this overwhelming feeling of affection for him and were raising the money to rename the school gym for him. And at the same time, the parents of the current players were trying to get him fired because he was too tough. So the story wasn't just a nostalgia piece about me and this coach. The story ended up being about sort of how the world's changed and how someone like this who is able to get inside my head is now being prevented from getting inside the heads of kids because the parents don't want him there.
Mm. My recollection, since I read the piece, didn't this begin as a beautiful New York Times Magazine
piece?
Well,
this is exactly what happened. As I wrote it last year for the New York Times Magazine, it was a quixotic then, and we put him on the cover of the Times Magazine, and the response to the thing was incredible, that around this country, not just coaches, but teachers who are trying to hold kids to higher standards, are having a horrible problem because the parents are meddling in ways they've just never meddled before. And I had hundreds of requests from hundreds of schools to reprint this article, to come talk to them about it. And so I said, well, geez, well, why not just bring this out as a little book? Because I was not aware that this was something that was a big issue. I thought it was when you write about New Orleans, you just assume that it has nothing to do with the rest of the country. It's just such a bizarre place and so different from the rest of the country. But in this case, in this school, it did. And so I think, actually, I'm not very far from the pulse right now with this little thing. We must concede, though, it's a very small book. It's 94 pages long. I had some trepidation of offering it up as a book. My publisher assured me that actually some people do like short books, so we went with it.
Seems to me it's kind of about a clash of generations in a sense. I mean, we're talking about two different periods in time and a single individual being like a mirror of the feelings of the people of those time. I think what's interesting to me is that you were part of both generations. I mean, you were the kid who got maybe beaten up a little bit by Coach Fitz in a good way that you appreciate, but now you and your generation are the parents who are arguably trying to get Coach Fitz fired.
I would like to think that I would take the side of Coach Fitz if I were in that place. But it's really interesting how the world's changed. And he himself, he's an educated man. And he's an intelligent man. He has a lot to say on the subject of how the world's changed. And one of the things he says, I don't think he completely describes the change in the world, but one of the things he says is very interesting. He said, look, when you were coming along, there was still this fairly old-fashioned idea that self-esteem was something you earned. You started with none of it, and it was by what you did that you acquired it. He said, I now find that the general assumption of parents is that their kids are born with their self-esteem, and it's a fixed quantity. And any threat to that self-esteem in the form of coaches yelling at them, for example, is a very bad thing. It reduces the fixed quantity. And he gets himself in trouble for that reason. But I think the bigger issue is what's happened in childhood in this country. And what's happened is it's become a career. It's become part of your career. It's not separate from your career. And there's this horrible anxiety on the part of parents when they see their children failing or made uncomfortable when they're 14, 15, 16 years old, because they're all of a sudden connecting it to, I mean, they can all of a sudden see the connections between failure at 14 and not getting into Harvard and not being an investment banker on Wall Street or whatever it is they hope for their children to be. And this is very different from the childhood I had. I had no sense that I was supposed to, that I was going to go on to achieve anything in life, or that what I did when I was in school was connected to it. And so that's a very big difference.
Hmm. What type of CEO would Coach Fitz have been?
He would have been the CEO who did not pay himself a lot of money. Let me tell you one interesting thing about him. When the piece would appear in the Times Magazine, everybody and his brother was calling that little school in New Orleans and asking to interview him. I mean, 2020 and Barbara Walters, Larry King, he could have been all over the television set. He wanted nothing to do with it. He had no interest in being a celebrity. All he wanted to do was be a coach, even though he'd have made a very good celebrity. He leads by example. He led by example as a coach. He was always the hardest working person on the team and never missed a day, no matter how sick he was. And cared more than anybody. If he was a CEO, he would not be paying himself $20 million to run his company. He'd be the guy who was underpaid for the job he was doing. And he would be loved and admired by the people who work for him, I bet. What I wonder is, how would these CEOs, how would our leadership class fare in a Coach Fitz type regime? I think an awful lot of these guys who run big companies would benefit from having their butts kicked by this guy and given a sense of what it means to cooperate in a common cause and what your duty is rather than what your desire is. And these are the things that Coach Fitz tries to teach people.
Hmm. And you spoke to this a bit earlier, Michael, but could a Coach Fitz get hired today?
I don't know. I think that he would have been fired already if he did not have this huge reservoir of goodwill in the alumni. I mean, if he hadn't been around so long, I don't think he'd still be around. I think that if he was, there's no question in my mind, actually, that if he was who he was when we met him and tried to do that today as a new 27-year-old coach, that they'd have him out of there so fast, he wouldn't know what happened to him. So, no, I don't think so. And my impression is that coaches like him, you know, not just coaches, English teachers wrote me saying, look, I've been the English teacher who was always the tough teacher in the school and people didn't want to take me, but years later they wrote and thanked me that they had grammar. And now I can't do it. Now I'm having trouble because the parents say that, oh, you can't give my Johnny a B-minus because Johnny's supposed to go to Yale. Even though Johnny deserved a B-. And they get the headmaster involved. They say, look, we're paying a huge tuition here. This teacher's unfair. And I think that there is a general kind of softness in the educational system. And it's particularly, I think, I mean, it's weird in a way. I think it's particularly in the fancier schools. I think that the parents, they've gotten so money-dependent, and they've gotten so rich at the same time, which is a paradox. But they've gotten so money dependent that their parents have become customers, and they're afraid to frighten the money away.
Mm. A best-selling book was once written about Bobby Knight, the famously cantankerous and some would say abusive college basketball coach. The title of the book was Season on the Brink. It was a wonderful book. It was by a guy named John Feinstein. And after it was published, as you well know, I'm sure, Bobby Knight really, really didn't like John Feinstein for writing that book.
I vaguely remember all this.
Is Coach Fitz grateful to you for writing the book? Has he thanked you? Do you have a good? Has it changed your relationship with him?
Well, you know, I think he was a little moved that someone actually cared enough to go and write something about the effect that he'd had on him. But I tell you this, when the piece appeared, when he was on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, he saw the thing 2 days before the public did because he got an advance copy. And he didn't say anything to me, but I know he turned to his wife and said, I'm fired. They're going to fire me when this thing comes out. That this is going to be so controversial that I won't keep my job. And he didn't blame me for it. He wasn't angry. He just assumed that was it. And by Wednesday, after the piece appeared and Barbara Walters and everybody else had called, he had been put on the search committee to find the new headmaster. So not only was he not fired, he was empowered, because what happened was people behave differently when they know they're being watched than when they think they can operate in the shadows. And the parents who had been meddling, all of a sudden, they all shut up. They were all mortified, I think, and they weren't willing to fight their fights in the open. And a lot of parents who had just been a silent majority, not aware of what had happened, and alumni rose up very upset that he had been faced this problem for so long. And he said to me, I got him on the phone not long after that, and he told me, I'm on the search committee. He was perplexed to find my new boss. And he'd interviewed, you know, assistant headmasters at Andover and so on and so forth who were going down there to interview for the job. And I said, Billy, was it fun? He said, oh yeah, it was a lot of fun. I said, had they read the article? And he said, oh yeah, they'd read the article. And I said, well, how would you know? And he said, they were terrified. They would come in and they would have read of Coach Fitz. And they had in the back of their mind every bad thing they'd ever done in their lives was on their conscience. Mm. And they were terrified of this man. They were like, it was like they were meeting their maker. So I think it's worked out very well for him in the end.
Michael Lewis, author of the book Coach, Lessons on the Game of Life. You mentioned earlier it's not a long book. I think you said it was 94 pages. One of our producers just wrote me out a note. He's asking, well, he wants to know if Coach is shorter or longer than Bridges of Madison County.
The words are a little longer, but the book is shorter.
Michael, the subtitle of your book, Lessons on the Game of Life, I feel as if you've spoken to that a little bit, but is there any lesson that you'd really like to underscore here?
There are many lessons in the thing, but the big thing this coach did for me was, and this was interesting because he was interested in winning, and he won many state championships, but it wasn't all about winning for him. It was about the way you went about it. It was really, as corny as it sounded, it was the way you played the game. And what the one thing he... By sadly putting me through a lot of it, by putting me through a lot of failure, he gave me a real comfort with failure. He taught me what it felt like to operate when I was feeling uncomfortable. And that, I think, is something you can learn at that age relatively painlessly. And if you don't learn it, you get in for some trouble probably, because every life has some discomfort in it and some failure in it. And really successful people, this is why I find, when you talk to really successful people, one thing they have in common is they've just ignored a lot of failure because no one just is just successful all the time. And what you also find people who didn't realize potential because failure and the discomfort that went with it just prevented them from continuing to try. So I would say that if they're, it's probably parents who are listening, that the real lesson here is if there is a man or woman, who a teacher in one of your kids' schools, who is seeming to make your children uncomfortable, pause for a bit before you go and call the headmaster and tell them they shouldn't be doing this, because they may be doing in a child the greatest service that can be done.
Mm. Michael Lewis, his new book, Coach, Lessons on the Game of Life. Thank you for joining us on the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thank you, David.
Born.